From National Public Radio in Washington, this is a special report, President Clinton's address to Congress on health care reform. I'm Robert Siegel, and tonight the president unveils what is likely to be the boldest effort of his presidency, an effort to guarantee universal access to health insurance to all Americans. Before the evening is out, we're likely to hear the president describe his plan, which extends coverage to the uninsured, guarantees a package of benefits to which all Americans would be entitled, and we are also likely to hear his proposals for holding down health care costs and eliminating inefficiencies. Perhaps the most controversial aspect of all that we'll hear this evening will be the administration's estimate of how much of the cost of health care reform can be defrayed through savings gained by greater efficiency. Later in the evening, the Republicans will respond to the president. Joining to report on and analyze this address this evening are NPR's lead correspondent on health care reform for the past several months, Patricia Naiman, and senior news analyst Daniel Shore. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
We're hearing now the sound of a chamber that is awaiting the president to arrive, and when he does, you'll hear the doorkeeper to the House, James Molloy, introduce the president. But until then, let's talk a little bit about what we're likely to hear this evening. First of all, the president's going to tell us that he has a plan to save billions of dollars. That's applause, by the way, is for the First Lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton, taking her place in the gallery. We're going to hear the president talk about saving billions of dollars. Dan Shore, if you were to try to look ahead to this plan, this isn't simply a matter of budgeting or trying to help the country fiscally. This is a major social initiative the president's undertaking.
Oh, it is probably the greatest social initiative in this country since President Franklin Roosevelt introduced Social Security to the country. In a sense, it's the other half of that whole revolution in which this country has lagged so far behind European countries, Canada, and most of the civilized world. It is to extend the idea of universal health coverage, or health security, as they call it, which is now a principle widely accepted throughout the world and slowly now being introduced to the United States.
And the phrase health security, Patricia Naiman, is one we're likely to hear quite a bit, if not tonight, then certainly in the coming days, an echo of Social Security. But security in this case means that we needn't fear for loss of health insurance.
Of health insurance, or the fear that we won't get medical care when we need it. It's been a concern in poll after poll that Americans are frightened that they'll be dropped from coverage. They know someone who has. They're afraid that they may not get reimbursed for the cost of care. And health security is likely to be the selling point of the campaign.
But no, I think that Mr. Molloy is announcing
yes,
the arrival
indeed.
Of the
mm-hmm.
president. You'll probably want to talk about that.
Well, the president is just about to enter the House chamber, preceded by his cabinet secretaries and a cabinet which, according to news reports, has not been uniformly in support of the plan as it has emerged. This is a plan that the president, Mrs. Clinton, president's very longtime friend and close advisor Ira Magaziner have been developing for quite a while. But it is said, at least according to the Wall Street Journal and others, Dan Shore, that there were voices within the administration who felt that estimates of savings, Patty, were not there, they said.
There are a number of people who apparently have challenged the savings, and also a number of cabinet members who apparently didn't like the idea of going with this, the so-called plan for managed competition. They wanted a plan similar to the Canadian plan, where the government administers health care. Mm-hmm. So there were some big differences.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem has been in that in order to try to calculate what cost savings will be as you introduce reforms, you have to make certain assumptions that if we, for example, have a more efficient way of delivering Medicare, then we will save so much for Medicare. Well, the other day, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan said that those cost-saving figures are fantasy, he said. Accurate fantasy, but fantasy, meaning they come accurately out of the computer if you accept certain premises, but he apparently doesn't accept the premises, and some of the people in Treasury and elsewhere in the mm-hmm. government had some doubts about it. In order to embrace the figures, you have to embrace the concept and have the vision to think that what they say will work that way.
Well, now the president is actually entering the House chamber to the applause of members of Congress, and he'll no doubt shake some hands along the way as he walks toward the front of the chamber to give this address, which, by the way, according to White House Press Secretary Dee Dee Myers, the spokesperson of the White House, is likely to run in excess of 45 minutes. These things are rough, of course, because there are likely to be interruptions for applause, and also, Dan, sure, because the president is sometimes given to improvising.
That's right. You remember his famous speech on his economic plan last February, when he got a good reception, and then soared and took off to a point where the men operating the teleprompter couldn't keep up with him for a while. And the speech became then, in large part, ad-lib. He tends to do that when he's inspired by his audience. And if he gets a good reception, there is no doubt that he will depart from his prepared speech. If he does, we will not know it, because we don't have any copy of his prepared speech. Because we heard that they were working on it and tinkering with it and making last-minute changes in it up until just a few minutes ago.
The president, when he takes his place momentarily, is approaching the podium right now, will typically be standing with the presidents of the two chambers of the Congress behind him. That is to say, the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, and the President of the Senate, who is, of course, the Vice President of the United States, Albert Gore. And so it will look much like a State of the Union address to a joint session. This, of course, is the presentation of a major effort that indeed might have been ready some weeks ago, but with the Congress absorbed with the economic package through June, it was necessary to wait and not create too much of a logjam in the Congress with too many huge legislative packages. This one, though, I believe, like the budget package, will concern itself with many committees of the House and the Senate before it's finished, and there's no guaranteeing that what we hear described in the speech that's about to begin is actually going to be the program that will be enacted into law sometime.
Well, in any event, it's going to be a very general statement, and it'll be 5 to 6 weeks before it can be translated into specific legislation to be offered to the Congress. I don't think he's going to go very much into detail. If he did, this would not be a speech of 45 minutes, but maybe 45 hours, of which I must say he's quite capable, but we're trusting he will not choose to do that tonight or this week. I think this will be the speech trying to set the basis for a debate and set the premises and the floor on which he will offer it. Don't expect all those details to come spilling out tonight.
Okay, well, here we go. The president addressing Congress and the nation about health care.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
That is, of course, Speaker of the House Foley. It's his chamber, so he has introduced the President, who is at the microphone and appears ready to begin, acknowledging the applause with waves to the legislators who are assembled in the House chamber. Many of them, if not all, standing to applaud and greet him.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of Congress, distinguished guests, my fellow Americans, before I begin my words tonight, I would like to ask that we all bow in a moment of silent prayer for the memory of those who were killed and those who have been injured in the tragic train accident in Alabama today. Amen. My fellow Americans, tonight we come together to write a new chapter in the American story. Our forebears enshrined the American dream, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Every generation of Americans has worked to strengthen that legacy, to make our country a place of freedom and opportunity, a place where people who work hard can rise to their full potential, a place where their children can have a better future. From the settling of the frontier to the landing on the moon, ours has been a continuous story of challenges defined, obstacles overcome, new horizons secured. That is what makes America what it is, and Americans what we are. Now we are in a time of profound change and opportunity. The end of the Cold War the information age, the global economy hath brought us both opportunity and hope, and strife and uncertainty. Our purpose in this dynamic age must be to make change our friend and not our enemy. To achieve that goal, we must face all our challenges with confidence, with faith, and with discipline. Whether we're reducing the deficit, creating tomorrow's jobs and training our people to fill them, converting from a high-tech defense to a high-tech domestic economy, expanding trade, reinventing government, making our streets safer, or rewarding work over idleness. All these challenges require us to change. If Americans are to have the courage to change in a difficult time, we must first be secure in our most basic needs. Tonight, I want to talk to you about the most critical thing we can do to build that security. This healthcare system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it. Despite the dedication of literally millions of talented healthcare professionals, our healthcare is too uncertain and too expensive, too bureaucratic and too wasteful. It has too much fraud and too much greed. At long last, after decades of false starts, we must make this our most urgent priority. Giving every American health security, health care that can never be taken away, health care that is always there. That is what we must do tonight. On this journey, as on all others of true consequence, there will be rough spots in the road and honest disagreements about how we should proceed. After all, this is a complicated issue. But every successful journey is guided by fixed stars. And if we can agree on some basic values and principles, we will reach this destination and we will reach it together. So tonight I want to talk to you about the principles that I believe must embody our efforts to reform America's healthcare system. Security. Simplicity. Savings, choice, quality, and responsibility. When I launched our nation on this journey to reform the healthcare system, I knew we needed a talented navigator, someone with a rigorous mind, a steady compass, a caring heart. Luckily for me and for our nation, I didn't have to look very far.
Standing ovation for Hillary Rodham Clinton, who has stood in the gallery to acknowledge the applause of the Congress. With her is Dr. Everett Koop, former Surgeon General of the United States under President Reagan, her guest.
Over the last 8 months, Hillary and those working with her have talked to literally thousands of Americans to understand the strengths and the frailties of this system of ours. They met with over 1,100 healthcare organizations. They talk with doctors and nurses, pharmacists and drug company representatives, hospital administrators, drug insurance company executives, and small and large businesses. They spoke with self-employed people. They talked with people who had insurance and people who didn't. They talked with union members and older Americans and advocates for our children. The First Lady also consulted, as all of you know, extensively with governmental leaders in both parties, in the states of our nation, and especially here on Capitol Hill. Hillary and the task force received and read over 700,000 letters from ordinary citizens. What they wrote and the bravery with which they told their stories is really what calls us all here tonight. Every one of us knows someone who's worked hard and played by the rules and still been hurt by this system that just doesn't work for too many people. But I'd like to tell you about just one. Kerry Kennedy owns a small furniture store that employs 7 people in Titusville, Florida. Like most small business owners, he's poured his heart and soul, his sweat and blood, into that business for years. But over the last several years, again like most small business owners, he's seen his health care premiums skyrocket, even in years when no claims were made. And last year, he painfully discovered he could no longer afford to provide coverage for all his workers because his insurance company told him that 2 of his workers had become high risks because of their advanced age. The problem was that those 2 people were his mother and father, the people who founded the business and still worked in the store. This story speaks for millions of others. And from them, we have learned a powerful truth. We have to preserve and strengthen what is right with the healthcare system, but we have got to fix what is wrong with it. Now, we all know what's right. We're blessed with the best healthcare professionals on earth, the finest healthcare institutions, the best medical research, the most sophisticated technology. My mother is a nurse. I grew up around hospitals. Doctors and nurses were the first professional people I ever knew or learned to look up to. They are what is right with this healthcare system. But we also know that we can no longer afford to continue to ignore what is wrong. Millions of Americans are just a pink slip away from losing their health insurance, and one serious illness away from losing all their savings. Millions more are locked into the jobs they have now just because they or someone in their family has once been sick and they have what is called a pre-existing condition. And on any given day, over 37 million Americans, most of them working people and their little children, have no health insurance at all. And in spite of all this, our medical bills are growing at over twice the rate of inflation, and the United States spends over a third more of its income on health care than any other nation on earth, and the gap is growing, causing many of our companies and global competition severe disadvantage. There is no excuse for this kind of system. We know other people have done better. We know people in our own country are doing better. We have no excuse. My fellow Americans, we must fix this system, and it has to begin with congressional action. I believe, as strongly as I can say, that we can reform the costliest and most wasteful system on the face of the earth without enacting new broad-based taxes. I believe it because of the conversations I have had with thousands of healthcare professionals around the country, with people who are outside this city but are inside experts on the way this system works and wastes money. The proposal that I describe tonight borrows many of the principles and ideas that have been embraced in plans introduced by both Republicans and Democrats in this Congress. For the first time in this century, leaders of both political parties have joined together around the principle of providing universal, comprehensive health care. It is a magic moment, and we must seize it. I want to say to all of you, I have been deeply moved by the spirit of this debate, by the openness of all people to new ideas and argument and information. The American people would be proud to know that earlier this week, when a healthcare university was held for members of Congress just to try to give everybody the same amount of information, over 320 Republicans and Democrats signed up and showed up for 2 days just to learn the basic facts of the complicated problem before us. Both sides are willing to say, we have listened to the people. We know the cost of going forward with this system is far greater than the cost of change. Both sides, I think, understand the literal ethical imperative of doing something about the system we have now. Rising above these difficulties and our past differences to solve this problem will go a long way toward defining who we are and who we intend to be as a people in this difficult and challenging era. I believe we all understand that. And so tonight, let me ask all of you, every member of the House, every member of the Senate, each Republican and each Democrat, let us keep this spirit and let us keep this commitment until this job is done. We owe it to the American people. Now, if I might, I would like to review the six principles I mentioned earlier and describe how we think we can best fulfill those principles. First and most important, security. This principle speaks to the human misery, to the costs, to the anxiety we hear about every day, all of us, when people talk about their problems with the present system. Security means that those who do not now have health care coverage will have it, and for those who have it, it will never be taken away. We must achieve that security as soon as possible. Under our plan, every American would receive a health care security card that will guarantee a comprehensive package of benefits over the course of an entire lifetime, roughly comparable to the benefit package offered by most Fortune 500 companies. This health care security card will offer this package of benefits in a way that can never be taken away. So let us agree on this, whatever else we disagree on. Before this Congress finishes its work next year, you will pass and I will sign legislation to guarantee this security to every citizen of this country.
As the President described, the card, health security card that every American would have, he held up such a card, a prototype of it at least, and showed it to the Congress as he described what it would do.
With this card, if you lose your job or you switch jobs, you're covered. If you leave your job to start a small business, you're covered. If you're an early retiree, you're covered. If someone in your family has unfortunately had an illness that qualifies as a pre-existing condition, you're still covered. If you get sick or a member of your family gets sick, even if it's a life-threatening illness, you're covered. And if an insurance company tries to drop you for any reason, you will still be covered because that will be illegal. This card will give comprehensive coverage. It will cover people for hospital care, doctor visits, emergency and lab services, diagnostic services like pap smears and mammograms and cholesterol tests, substance abuse, and mental health treatment.
The President has continued to hold that health security card in his hand as he has described what health security would entail under his plan.
And equally important, for both health care and economic reasons, this program for the first time would provide a broad range of preventive services, including regular checkups and well baby visits. It's just common sense. We know any family doctor will tell you that people will stay healthier and long-term costs to the health system will be lower if we have comprehensive preventive services. You know how all of our mothers told us that an ounce of prevention was worth a pound of cure? Our mothers were right. And it's a lesson, like so many lessons from our mothers, that we have waited too long to live by. It is time to start doing it.
It's the second plug for motherhood in this speech.
Healthcare security must also apply to older Americans. This is something I imagine all of us in this room feel very deeply about. So the first thing I want to say about that is that we must maintain the Medicare program. It works to provide that kind of security. But this time, and for the first time, I believe Medicare should provide coverage for the cost of prescription drugs. Yes, it will cost some more in the beginning. But again, any physician who deals with the elderly will tell you that there are thousands of elderly people in every state who are not poor enough to be on Medicaid, but just above that line and on Medicare, who desperately need medicine, who make decisions every week between medicine and food. Any doctor who deals with the elderly will tell you that there are many elderly people who don't get medicine, who get sicker and sicker and eventually go to the doctor and wind up spending more money and draining more money from the healthcare system than they would if they had regular treatment in the way that only adequate medicine can provide. I also believe that over time we should phase in long-term care for the disabled and the elderly on a comprehensive basis. As we proceed with this health care reform, we cannot forget that the most rapidly growing percentage of Americans are those over 80. We cannot break faith with them. We have to do better by them. The second principle is simplicity. Our health care system must be simpler for the patients and simpler for those who actually deliver health care, our doctors, our nurses, our other medical professionals. Today, we have more than 1,500 insurers with hundreds and hundreds of different forms. No other nation has a system like this. These forms are time-consuming for healthcare providers. They're expensive for healthcare consumers. They're exasperating for anyone who's ever tried to sit down around a table and wade through them and figure them out. The medical care industry is literally drowning in paperwork. In recent years, the number of administrators in our hospitals has grown by four times the rate that the number of doctors has grown. A hospital ought to be a house of healing, not a monument to paperwork and bureaucracy. Just a few days ago, the Vice President and I had the honor of visiting the Children's Hospital here in Washington, where they do wonderful, often miraculous things for very sick children. A nurse named Debbie Freiberg told us that she was in the cancer and bone marrow unit. And the other day, a little boy asked her just to stay at his side during his chemotherapy. And she had to walk away from that child because she had been instructed to go to yet another class to learn how to fill out another form for something that didn't have a lick to do with the health care of the children she was helping. That is wrong, and we can stop it, and we ought to do it. We met a very compelling doctor named Lillian Beard, a pediatrician, who said that she didn't get into her profession to spend hours and hours, some doctors up to 25 hours a week, just filling out forms. She told us she became a doctor to keep children well and to help save those who got sick. We can relieve people like her of this burden. We learned, the Vice President and I did, that in the Washington Children's Hospital alone, the administrators told us they spend $2 million a year in one hospital filling out forms that have nothing whatever to do with keeping up with the treatment of the patients. And the doctors there applauded when I was told, and I related to them, that they spend so much time filling out paperwork that if they only had to fill out those paperwork requirements necessary to monitor the health of the children, each doctor on that one hospital staff, 200 of them, could see another 500 children a year. That is 10,000 children a year. I think we can save money in this system if we simplify it, and we can make the doctors and the nurses and the people that are giving their lives to help us all be healthier a whole lot happier, too, on their jobs. Under our proposal, there would be one standard insurance form, not hundreds of them. We will simplify also, and we must, the government's rules and regulations, because they are a big part of this problem. This is one of those cases where the physician should heal thyself. We have to reinvent the way we relate to the healthcare system, along with reinventing government. A doctor should not have to check with a bureaucrat in an office thousands of miles away before ordering a simple blood test. That's not right, and we can change it. And doctors, nurses, and consumers shouldn't have to worry about the fine print. If we have this one simple form, there won't be any fine print. People will know what it means. The third principle is savings. Reform must produce savings in this healthcare system. It has to. We're spending over 14% of our income on healthcare. Canada's at 10, nobody else is over 9. We're competing with all these people for the future. And the other major countries, they cover everybody, and they cover them with services as generous as the best company policies here in this country. Rampant medical inflation is eating away at our wages, our savings, our investment capital, our ability to create new jobs in the private sector, and this public treasury. You know the budget we just adopted had steep cuts in defense, a 5-year freeze on the discretionary spending so critical to re-educating America and investing in jobs and helping us to convert from a defense to a domestic economy. But we passed a budget which has Medicaid increases of between 16 and 11% a year over the next 5 years, and Medicare increases of between 11 and 9% in an environment where we assume inflation will be at 4% or less. We cannot continue to do this. Our competitiveness, our whole economy, the integrity of the way the government works, and ultimately our living standards depend upon our ability to achieve savings without harming the quality of health care. Unless we do this, our workers will lose $655 in income each year by the end of the decade. Small businesses will continue to face skyrocketing premiums, and a full third of small businesses now covering their employees say they will be forced to drop their insurance. Large corporations will bear bigger disadvantages in global competition, and health care costs will devour more and more and more of our budget. Pretty soon, all of you or the people who succeed you will be showing up here and writing out checks for health care and interest on the debt, and worrying about whether we've got enough defense, and that'll be it, unless we have the courage to achieve the savings that are plainly there before us. Every state and local government will continue to cut back on everything from education to law enforcement to pay more and more for the same health care. These rising costs are a special nightmare for our small businesses, the engine of our entrepreneurship and our job creation in America today. Healthcare premiums for small businesses are 35% higher than those of large corporations today, and they will keep rising at double-digit rates unless we act. So how will we achieve these savings? Rather than looking at price controls or looking away as the price spiral continues, rather than using the heavy hand of government to try to control what's happening or continuing to ignore what's happening, we believe there is a third way to achieve these savings. First, to give groups of consumers and small businesses the same market bargaining power that large corporations and large groups of public employees now have. We want to let market forces enable plans to compete. We want to force these plans to compete on the basis of price and quality, not simply to allow them to continue making money by turning people away who are sick or old or performing mountains of unnecessary procedures. But we also believe we should back this system up with limits on how much plans can raise their premiums year in and year out, forcing people again to continue to pay more for the same health care without regard to inflation or the rising population needs. We want to create what has been missing in this system for too long and what every successful nation who has dealt with this problem has already had to do, to have a combination of private market forces and a sound public policy that will support that competition but limit the rate at which prices can exceed the rate of inflation and population growth if the competition doesn't work, especially in the early going. Second thing I want to say is that unless everybody is covered, and this is a very important thing, unless everybody is covered, we will never be able to fully put the brakes on health care inflation. Why is that? Because when people don't have any health insurance, they still get health care. But they get it when it's too late, when it's too expensive, often from the most expensive place of all, the emergency room. Usually by the time they show up, their illnesses are more severe and their mortality rates are much higher in our hospitals than those who have insurance. So they cost us more. And what else happens? Since they get the care but they don't pay, who does pay? All the rest of us. We pay in higher hospital bills and higher insurance premiums. This cost shifting is a major problem. Third thing we can do to save money is simply by simplifying the system, what we've already discussed. Freeing the healthcare providers from these costly and unnecessary paperwork and administrative decisions will save tens of billions of dollars. We spend twice as much as any other major country does on paperwork. We spend at least a dime on the dollar more than any other major country. That is a stunning statistic. It is something that every Republican and every Democrat ought to be able to say, we agree that we're going to squeeze this out. We cannot tolerate this. This has nothing to do with keeping people well or helping them when they're sick. We should invest the money in something else. We also have to crack down on fraud and abuse in the system. That drains billions of dollars a year. It is a very large figure, according to every healthcare expert I've ever spoken with. So I believe we can achieve large savings. And that large savings can be used to cover the unemployed, uninsured, and will be used for people who realize those savings in the private sector to increase their ability to invest and grow, to hire new workers, or to give their workers pay raises, many of them for the first time in years. Now, nobody has to take my word for this. You can ask Dr. Koop. He's up here with us tonight, and I thank him for being here. Thank you, sir.
President acknowledges C. Everett Koop, former Surgeon General, who seated between the First Lady
since
and Mrs. Gore.
His distinguished tenure as our Surgeon General, he has spent an enormous amount of time studying our health care system, how it operates, what's right and wrong with it. He says we could spend $200 billion every year, more than 20% of the total budget, without sacrificing the high quality of American medicine. Ask the public employees in California who've held their own premiums down by adopting the same strategy that I want every American to be able to adopt, bargaining within the limits of a strict budget. Ask Xerox, which saved an estimated $1,000 per worker on their health insurance premiums. Ask the staff of the Mayo Clinic, who we all agree provides some of the finest health care in the world. They are holding their cost increases to less than half the national average. Ask the people of Hawaii, the only state that covers virtually all of their citizens and has still been able to keep costs below the national average. Now, people may disagree over the best way to fix this system. We may all disagree about how quickly we can do what, thing that we have to do. But we cannot disagree that we can find tens of billions of dollars in savings in what is clearly the most costly and the most bureaucratic system in the entire world. And we have to do something about that. And we have to do it now. The fourth principle is choice. Americans believe they ought to be able to choose their own health care plans and keep their own doctors. And I think all of us agree. And under any plan we pass, they ought to have that right. But today, under our broken health care system, in spite of the rhetoric of choice, the fact is that that power is slipping away from more and more Americans. Of course, it is usually the employer, not the employee, who makes the initial choice of what health care plan the employee will be in. And if your employer offers only one plan, as nearly three-quarters of small and business medium-sized firms do today, you're stuck with that plan and the doctors that it covers. We propose to give every American a choice among high-quality plans. You can stay with your current doctor, join a network of doctors and hospitals, or join a health maintenance organization. If you don't like your plan, every year you'll have the chance to choose a new one. The choice will be left to the American citizen, the worker, not the boss, and certainly not some government bureaucrat. We also believe that doctors should have a choice as to what plans they practice in. Otherwise, citizens may have their own choices limited. We want to end the discrimination that is now growing against doctors and to permit them to practice in several different plans. Choice is important for doctors, and it is absolutely critical for our consumers. We've got to have it in whatever plan we pass. The fifth principle is quality. If we reformed everything else in health care but failed to preserve and enhance the high quality of our medical care, we will have taken a step backward, not forward. Quality is something that we simply can't leave to chance. When you board an airplane, you feel better knowing that the plane had to meet standards designed to protect your safety. And we can't ask any less of our health care system. Our proposal will create report cards on health plans, so that consumers can choose the highest quality health care providers and reward them with their business. At the same time, our plan will track quality indicators so that doctors can make better and smarter choices of the kind of care they provide. We have evidence that more efficient delivery of health care doesn't decrease quality. In fact, it may enhance it. Let me just give you one example of one commonly performed procedure, the coronary bypass operation. Pennsylvania discovered that patients who were charged $21,000 for this surgery received as good or better care as patients who were charged $84,000 for the same procedure in the same state. High prices simply don't always equal good quality. Our plan will guarantee that high-quality information is available in even the most remote areas of this country, so that we can have high-quality service, linking rural doctors, for example, with hospitals, with high-tech urban medical centers. And our plan will ensure the quality of continuing progress on a whole range of issues by speeding research on effective prevention and treatment measures for cancer, for AIDS, for Alzheimer's, for heart disease, and for other chronic diseases. We have to safeguard the finest medical research establishment in the entire world. And we will do that with this plan. Indeed, we will even make it better. The sixth and final principle is responsibility. We need to restore a sense that we're all in this together and that we all have a responsibility to be a part of the solution. Responsibility has to start with those who profit from the current system. Responsibility means insurance companies should no longer be allowed to cast people aside when they get sick. It should apply to laboratories that submit fraudulent bills, to lawyers who abuse malpractice claims, to doctors who order unnecessary procedures. It means drug companies should no longer charge three times more for prescription drugs made in America, here in the United States, than they charge for the same drugs overseas. In short, responsibility should apply to anybody who abuses this system and drives up the cost for honest, hardworking citizens and undermines confidence in the honest, gifted healthcare providers we have. Responsibility also means changing some behaviors in this country that drive up our costs like crazy, and without changing them, we'll never have the system we ought to have. We will never. Let me just mention a few and start with the most important. The outrageous costs of violence in this country stem in large measure from the fact that this is the only country in the world where teenagers can rout the streets at random with semi-automatic weapons and be better armed than the police.
Very enthusiastic standing ovation for many of the members of Congress in response to the president's remarks about the easy access to guns. He mentioned automatic weapons. He's saying this is one of the things, one of our cultural traits that drives up our medical bill.
Let's not kid ourselves. It's not that simple. We also have higher rates of AIDS, of smoking and excessive drinking, of teen pregnancy, of low birth weight babies, and we have the third worst immunization rate of any nation in the Western Hemisphere. We have to change our ways if we ever really want to be healthy as a people and have an affordable health care system. And no one can deny that. But let me say this, and I hope every American will listen, because this is not an easy thing to hear. Responsibility in our health care system isn't just about them. It's about you. It's about me. It's about each of us. Too many of us have not taken responsibility for our own health care and for our own relations to the health care system. Many of us who've had fully paid health care plans have used the system, whether we needed it or not, without thinking what the costs were. Many people who use this system don't pay a penny for their care, even though they can afford to. I think those who don't have any health insurance should be responsible for paying a portion of their new coverage. There can't be any something for nothing, and we have to demonstrate that to people. This is not a free system. Even small contributions, as small as a $10 copayment when you visit a doctor, illustrates that this is something of value. There is a cost to it. It is not free. And I want to tell you that I believe that all of us should have insurance. Why should the rest of us pick up the tab when a guy who doesn't think he needs insurance or says he can't afford it gets in an accident, winds up in an emergency room, gets good care, and everybody else pays? Why should the small business people who are struggling to keep afloat and take care of their employees have to pay to maintain this wonderful health care infrastructure for those who refuse to do anything? If we're going to produce a better health care system for every one of us, every one of us is going to have to do our part. There cannot be any such thing as a free ride. We have to pay for it. We have to pay for it. Tonight I want to say plainly how I think we should do that. Most of the money would come, under my way of thinking, as it does today, from premiums paid by employers and individuals. That's the way it happens today. But under this health care security plan, every employer and every individual will be asked to contribute something to health care. This concept was first conveyed to the Congress about 20 years ago by President Nixon. And today, a lot of people agree with the concept of shared responsibility between employers and employees, and that the best thing to do is to ask every employer and every employee to share that. The Chamber of Commerce has said that, and they're not in the business of hurting small business. The American Medical Association has said that. Some call it an employer mandate, but I think it's the fairest way to achieve responsibility in the health care system. And it's the easiest for ordinary Americans to understand because it builds on what we already have and what already works for so many Americans. It is a reform that is not only easiest to understand, but easiest to implement in a way that is fair to small business, because we can give a discount to help struggling small businesses meet the cost of covering their employees. We should require the least bureaucracy or disruption and create the cooperation we need to make the system cost conscious, even as we expand coverage. And we should do it in a way that does not cripple small businesses and low-wage workers. Every employer should provide coverage, just as three-quarters do now. Those that pay are picking up the tab for those who don't today. I don't think that's right. To finance the rest of reform, we can achieve new savings, as I have outlined, in both the federal government and the private sector through better decision-making and increased competition. And we will impose new taxes on tobacco. I don't think that should be the only source of revenues. I believe we should also ask for a modest contribution from big employers who opt out of the system to make up for what those who are in the system pay for medical research, for health education centers, for all the subsidies to small business, for all the things that everyone else is contributing to. But between those two things, we believe we can pay for this package of benefits and universal coverage and a subsidy program that will help small business. These sources can cover the cost of the proposal that I have described tonight. We subjected the numbers in our proposal to the scrutiny of not only of all the major agencies in government. I know a lot of people don't trust them, but it'd be interesting for the American people to know that this was the first time that the financial experts on health care and all the different government agencies had ever been required to sit in a room together and agree on numbers. It had never happened before. But obviously that's not enough. So then we gave these numbers to actuaries from major accounting firms and major Fortune 500 companies who have no stake in this other than to see that our efforts succeed. So I believe our numbers are good and achievable. Now, what does this mean to an individual American citizen? Some will be asked to pay more. If you're an employer and you aren't insuring your workers at all, you'll have to pay more. But if you're a small business with fewer than 50 employees, you'll get a subsidy. If you're a firm that provides only very limited coverage, you may have to pay more, but some firms will pay the same or less for more coverage. If you're a young single person in your 20s and you're already insured, your rates may go up somewhat because you're going to go into a big pool with middle-aged people and older people, and we want to enable people to keep their insurance even when someone in their family gets sick. But I think that's fair because when the young get older, they'll benefit from it, first. And secondly, even those who pay a little more today will benefit 4, 5, 6, 7 years from now by our bringing health care costs closer to inflation. Over the long run, we can all win, but some will have to pay more in the short run. Nevertheless, the vast majority of the Americans watching this tonight will pay the same or less for health care coverage that will be the same or better than the coverage they have tonight. That is the central reality. If you currently get your health insurance through your job under our plan, you still will. And for the first time, everybody will get to choose from among at least three plans to belong to. If you're a small business owner who wants to provide health insurance to your family and your employees, but you can't afford it because the system is stacked against you, this plan will give you a discount that will finally make insurance affordable. If you're already providing insurance, your rates may well drop because we'll help you as a small business person join thousands of others to get the same benefits big corporations get at the same price they get those benefits. If you're self-employed, you'll pay less, and you'll get to deduct from your taxes 100% of your health care premiums. If you're a large employer, your health care costs won't go up as fast, so that you will have more money to put into higher wages and new jobs and to put into the work of being competitive in this tough global economy. Now, these, my fellow Americans, are the principles on which I think we should base our efforts. Security, simplicity, savings, choice, quality, and responsibility. These are the guiding stars that we should follow on our journey toward health care reform. Over the coming months, you'll be bombarded with information from all kinds of sources. There will be some who will stoutly disagree with what I have proposed and with all other plans in the Congress, for that matter. And some of the arguments will be genuinely sincere and enlightening. Others may simply be scare tactics by those who are motivated by the self-interest they have in the waste the system now generates, because that waste is providing jobs, incomes, and money for some people. I ask you only to think of this. When you hear all these arguments, ask yourself whether the cost of staying on this same course isn't greater than the cost of change. And ask yourself, when you hear the arguments, whether the arguments are in your interests or someone else's. This is something we have got to try to do together. I want also to say to the representatives in Congress, you have a special duty to look beyond these arguments. I ask you instead to look into the eyes of a sick child who needs care, to think of the face of the woman who's been told not only that her condition is malignant, but not covered by her insurance, to look at the bottom lines of the businesses driven to bankruptcy by health care costs, to look at the for sale signs in front of the homes of families who've lost everything because of their health care costs. I ask you to remember the kind of people I met for the last year and a half. An elderly couple in New Hampshire that broke down and cried because of their shame at having an empty refrigerator to pay for their drugs. A woman who lost a $50,000 job that she used to support her six children because her youngest child was so ill that she couldn't keep health insurance, and the only way to get care for the child was to get public assistance. A young couple that had a sick child and could only get insurance from one of the parents' employers that was a nonprofit corporation with 20 employees, and so they had to face the question of whether to let this poor person with a sick child go or raise the premiums of every employee in the firm by $200. And on and on and on. I know we have differences of opinion, but we are here tonight in a spirit that is animated by the problems of those people and by the sure knowledge that if we can look into our hearts, we will not be able to say that the greatest nation in the history of the world is powerless to confront this crisis. Our history and our heritage tell us that we can meet this challenge. Everything about America's past tells us we will do it. So I say to you, let us write that new chapter in the American story. Let us guarantee every American comprehensive health benefits that can never be taken away. In spite of all the work we've done together and all the progress we've made, there are still a lot of people who say it would be an outright miracle if we passed health care reform. But my fellow Americans, in a time of change, you have to have miracles. And miracles do happen. I mean, just a few days ago, we saw a simple handshake shatter decades of deadlock in the Middle East. We've seen the walls crumble in Berlin and South Africa. We see the ongoing brave struggle of the people of Russia to seize freedom and democracy. And now, It is our turn to strike a blow for freedom in this country, the freedom of Americans to live without fear that their own nation's health care system won't be there for them when they need it. It's hard to believe that there was once a time in this century when that kind of fear gripped old age, when retirement was nearly synonymous with poverty, and older Americans died in the street. That's unthinkable today because over a half a century ago, Americans had the courage to change, to create a Social Security system that ensures that no Americans will be forgotten in their later years. 40 years from now, our grandchildren will also find it unthinkable that there was a time in this country when hardworking families lost their homes, their savings, their businesses, lost everything, simply because their children got sick or because they had to change jobs. Our grandchildren will find such things unthinkable tomorrow if we have the courage to change today. This is our chance. This is our journey. And when our work is done, we will know that we have answered the call of history and met the challenge of our time. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
President Bill Clinton concluding an address, 53-minute speech to a joint session of Congress in which he set forth his health security plan for the United States, a reform of our health care system. He spoke of six principles: security, simplicity, savings, choice, quality, responsibility. And he said it can be done without imposing a broad-based tax, but through employer contributions, some new taxes on tobacco. He didn't mention alcohol. And also a modest contribution from big employers who decide to opt out of the system. The president, in very animated fashion, has delivered an extremely important speech, a very bold initiative for his administration, indeed one of the boldest offered by any president recently to the Congress. You're listening to live coverage of an address by President Clinton to a joint session of Congress from National Public Radio. I'm Robert Siegel. Joining me in our studio in Washington are NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore and reporter NPR correspondent Patricia Naiman, who's been covering health care reform for this entire year and then some. And we've been listening to the speech. First, I want to ask both of you, Patty first, any surprises here?
Not really any surprises. Pretty much the principles that had been laid out in earlier speeches and by Mrs. Clinton in an earlier speech: security, simplicity, savings, choice, quality, and responsibility, things you already mentioned. What was interesting to me was the obvious reference a number of times in the speech to small business and how small business might benefit from this reform, an obvious effort to try to at least reach out to the community of small businesses that has been very vocal in their opposition to this plan.
The speech included a few anecdotes, the first one was about a small business in Florida and a small businessman who is so hard-pressed by rising health care costs that it's hard for him to insure his own parents when he started the business. Dan, any surprises for you here?
I wouldn't call it a surprise, but I thought that the emphasis on bipartisanship was very marked in his speech. I think that he managed to get a lot of applause from both sides of the aisle by laying down principles in a form in which, up to that point at least, they could be accepted by the members of both parties. And I think that by calling on them to sort of join him in this adventure, this mission of trying to resolve one of the most painful problems in America, I think he did manage to evoke a sense of bipartisanship. I would not be surprised when we hear the Republican reply that the willingness to cooperate and to look for solutions, even though they don't accept details, will be marked as well.
We're going to be hearing a reply in a few minutes, but I should recall, you spoke of his remarks on bipartisanship. The president actually called it a magic moment, the first time in this century, he said, when the leaders of both parties have joined in support of universal health coverage. Patty Naiman? I'm sorry, Dan, did I interrupt you?
No, I just wanted to add to that if you ask what this speech accomplished, what is very interesting is that all the 9 months of preparation in order to get this speech out did accomplish one thing. I don't know whether it's been the advanced preparation or whether the way the thing was been couched. There is agreement on one important element right now. Everybody seems to agree that we must have universal health care coverage, that you must have protection for everybody that they will have, that they will keep, will not lose as they change jobs or for any other reason. I did not think we would reach the point where we'd see everybody sitting there and saying, that's right, we've got to protect everybody.
And that is the major point of agreement, Patty, no? That has to be fixed.
Yes, and I was just going to add, Dan, you probably recall this better than I, but I think this is probably the first time when big business and so many businesses have been calling for some kind of reform. I don't know if that was the case in the 70s or not, but it seems like the idea of health care costs affecting a company's ability to compete, the Chryslers of the world and American Airlines, I mean, these companies were really pushing for some change.
That's right, and I thought he was rather adept in putting this in terms of competitiveness, that the health costs are not just costs by themselves, but they add to the price of a product and they have an effect on competitiveness. I think you're right, Patty, in that it really is true, of course, that one of the great beneficiaries of a system that he proposes would be big business, which 75% of which now has to pay for health plans which have escalating costs that they can't control. And anything that will control that cost would certainly be a great benefit for them. And it is very interesting that up until now we've seen more interest in this plan from big business than from small business.
Mm-hmm. When the president ran down how his plan, as he envisages it, would affect different sectors of society, big business, small business, the consumer, the hospital, you would have thought everybody comes out ahead in this, and yet to use his phrase, no broad-based tax. Would be tax on tobacco products, he said, there would be contributions from employers, which might be called a tax in other circumstances. But I wonder what people are likely to say about this and what other politicians are likely to say about such a huge program being proposed without a commensurate increase in taxation.
Especially since a poll taken by New York Times and CBS and published today indicates that 61% of Americans want health reform and are willing to pay more taxes to get it.
Mm-hmm. The numbers have come under a lot of tough scrutiny.
A lot of scrutiny, and I think the president tried to defend them tonight a number of times, saying that they'd submitted their numbers to many government agencies that had never before looked at them and sat in one room, and that they had submitted them to a number of independent actuaries who all agreed that the numbers were right. And when he's talking about the numbers, what he's referring to is the amount of savings that the administration projects they will extract from a more cost-efficient system under this reform. And they plan on using those savings to pay for any increased costs in this reform. And honestly, their numbers say that not only are they going to pay for any increased costs of the plan, but they're actually going to save money over a 5 to 7 year period. They hope to reduce the deficit by $93 billion. So they're actually talking about saving even more money.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk some more about what the president has said, but first we're going to hear what the opposition has to say. The Republicans have a response which we're going to hear in just a moment. It'll be presented by Carol Campbell, who is the governor of South Carolina, and a Republican governor, obviously, and a former colleague of Governor Clinton's in the National Governors Association. He was one of two Republicans actually on the president's task force, and he, in turn, will introduce two Republican members of Congress who are going to present their views, Representative Nancy Johnson, who's a Connecticut representative, and Senator Connie Mack of Florida, a state with a very high number of retirees and a consequently high health bill. Let's hear from the Republicans now.
Good evening. I'm Governor Carol Campbell from South Carolina. I'm joined by Congresswoman Nancy Johnson from Connecticut and Senator Connie Mack from Florida to offer a second opinion on the health care challenge. America is ready for health care reform, and so are we. We're just sorry the president didn't spell out the details of his plan. There are many plans on the table for consideration. And President and Mrs. Clinton deserve credit for bringing health care to the center stage of America. As we begin the national debate, we hope you'll remember these words: choice, quality, jobs, and cost. Those words are an important part of Nancy Johnson's comprehensive health care proposal, which was one of the first to be introduced in the Congress. Nancy?
Rarely is there an issue in Congress that so directly affects you and your family's health and well-being. Long before Bill Clinton became president, Republicans introduced solutions to to America's health care crisis. Tonight, we welcome the president's entry into this important dialogue. We support much of what he says. There are significant areas of agreement. For example, insurance reform to protect people from losing their health care coverage when they change or lose their jobs. Administrative reform to simplify paperwork and malpractice reform to eliminate unnecessary costs. There are other areas of common ground, and in the months ahead, we are committed to working hard to reach agreement on a health care plan that will serve all Americans. But tonight, we must point out, in the brief time we have, some fundamental differences of approach you and your family need to think about. First, we are concerned about the president's Washington-mandated one-size-fits-all approach. Should government really force almost all Americans to change health plans and buy health insurance through state-run monopolies? The president says he wants to reinvent government because bureaucracy is so inefficient and unresponsive. I agree. And like many of you, I'm more than a little reluctant to create dozens of new bureaucracies with unprecedented power over my health care. We think we have a better way. Our proposals level the playing field for those who work for small businesses and others without insurance so they can afford coverage. We're also very troubled by the president's proposal to mandate the cost of health care on small business. In my own state of Connecticut, many small employers are barely surviving. A new health care tax would certainly force layoffs and discourage hiring. You know, America is different. We're the land of opportunity because in America, you can open your own business and expand it far easier than in any other country. We need not sacrifice jobs or compromise economic opportunity to assure that all citizens have access to good health care. There are alternatives. For example, cutting the cost of insurance and expanding neighborhood health centers can create access to care without sacrificing jobs and opportunity. We believe that the American people want more choices, not more mandates. Finally, we disagree with a key part of the president's approach to controlling health care costs. We agree costs must be driven down, and we're pleased he supports our proposals to do just that. But we oppose what amounts to national price fixing. We've had experience with that approach. All bad. Ask any veteran. Ask any welfare recipient. Ironically, this approach also penalizes those who are doing the most to cut costs by promoting wellness. Companies that cut health care costs by investing in fitness programs will pay the very same tax that companies that don't. The Republican health care proposals are realistic. They expand access without mandates, preserve choice and flexibility, reduce costs, and provide health care security for you and your loved ones. Done right, health care reform will provide increasingly better care and greater security for all Americans. Connie?
Thank you, Nancy. In this important national debate about health care, we must never lose sight of one simple truth. The health care issue is not about numbers or percentages. It's about people. It's about families, yours and mine. I know this from personal experience. My wife, our daughter, my mother and I are all cancer survivors. My brother Michael died of cancer in 1979. Along with our doctors, we chose the treatment that was best for us during our illnesses. And we had a choice, and so should you. But you may not under the president's plan, and it's frightening. Read the Clinton administration's plan. It's loaded with more spending and more bureaucracy. It will devastate jobs in our economy. It will lead us to a system of government-controlled health care at a cost of $700 billion. That's billion with a B. It would create literally dozens of new agencies. We would see an explosion in the size, scope, and cost of government, a $700 billion explosion. The president's plan will force too many Americans to change their health care coverage. It will give a faceless government bureaucracy more control over your health care. It could even prevent your own doctor from treating you, and that's wrong. We want to reform the system to give you more control. After all, the fundamental right of each American is the right to make choices for ourselves. You know more about your health care needs than some bureaucrat. The emotional bond you have developed with your doctor could be lost when the government takes away your freedom to choose your own health care. I don't want bureaucracy to ration health care and decide when I'm sick and when I can't see my doctor. You and I know what's best for our families. America has the highest quality of health care in the world, and people come from every corner of the globe, especially those living under government-controlled health care systems. A woman in Florida told me that her father, who gets his care under Britain's government-controlled system, had to wait 18 months for a cataract operation. By then, his eyes were inoperable. And just north of our border, Canadians wait 7 months for cataract removal. We wouldn't tolerate that in America. My father had cataract surgery when he needed it, and I want to make certain that our senior citizens have the best care available when they need it. We're amazingly close to some significant breakthroughs in medicine, maybe the kind of discoveries that could have saved my brother's life. The American spirit of innovation and ingenuity can only flourish with less government, not more government. The debate tonight isn't about whether health care should be reformed. It's over how to do it. And we want it done right, with less government and more freedom. The Clinton administration's plan will sacrifice health care quality and lead to more spending, more government, fewer jobs, and less freedom for all of us. Republicans believe maintaining health care quality and ensuring individual choice is a better way. Carol?
There is common ground among the administration's plan, the bills introduced by Republicans in Congress, and the principles endorsed by the nation's governors. For example, we all agree that we need to increase access to health care and reduce paperwork. We need to change malpractice laws to cut legal costs and duplication. And we need to focus on prevention to save lives and cut costs. We agree that you shouldn't lose your health coverage just because you change jobs. And we want to make health insurance affordable for small businesses and individuals. I know you believe that, as I do, that America's health care system has become nearly as cumbersome and bureaucratic as the federal government, and there's plenty of room for reform in both. But a one-size-fits-all federal health care system will be bitter medicine for Americans to swallow. We need competition in the marketplace to bring quality and savings, and we need some answers about where we'll get the money to pay for this new system. More deficit spending is unacceptable, and we can't let the federal government shift more costs to state taxpayers and claim that they've made savings by capping Medicaid. We have some tough questions that demand clear answers. Will you be allowed to choose your own doctor and the type of coverage you want? How many jobs will be lost if the federal government sets the price small businesses pay to provide employee coverage? Do you really want the federal government to control your health care? Should we rely on the government with its track record to manage 1/7 of our economy? Do we want to grow the government or grow the private sector? We already have evidence that the federal bureaucracy can block real reform now going on in the states. Last week, Tennessee's 10-care proposal, which expands coverage to more low-income Tennesseans for the same Medicaid dollars, was shot down by Washington. In Arizona, Governor Symington has saved as much as 40% of his state's Medicaid costs with a managed care system. But he's having to go to Washington for a third time to ask for approval for reform that works. If we're serious about health care reform, Tennessee should already have its waiver, and Arizona shouldn't have to ask if it's okay to save money for the taxpayers. It's clear to me that we can't rely on heavy-handed government regulation and bureaucracies to lead the charge towards reform. The 238-page administration draft is a giant social experiment devised by theorists who have never met a payroll. But I am encouraged that the President and Mrs. Clinton have signaled their willingness to talk and to compromise. Republicans have promised the same. You know, my grandfather was a family doctor in rural South Carolina who believed that every individual deserved quality health care, and he delivered it. If a patient didn't have any money, My grandfather would accept farm products, or sometimes he'd just tear the bill up. Those days are gone. Do we need health care reform? Yes, we do. But not at the expense of your right to make basic choices for your family. The cure must not be worse than the disease. Republicans will work with the administration to forge a health care system that will work for you. We give you that commitment. Thank you. God bless you and good night.
Governor Carol Campbell of South Carolina speaking for the Republicans. Before him, you heard Senator Connie Mack of Florida and Representative Nancy Johnson of Connecticut. You're listening to live coverage of an address by President Clinton to a joint session of Congress and the Republican response, all from National Public Radio.